All right, everyone, if I could call us to order. My name is Jeff Harden from the Zoology Department, and I'm also part of the leadership team for the UW Faculty Staff Fellowship here, and thanks for coming. First of all, we want to make sure that everyone got a tan and a, I don't know what color this is, subtly non-white thing, two handouts, and hopefully everyone has those. Because I think our speaker today will be referencing those. It's my privilege to introduce our speaker today, and that's Dr. Chuck Hansen. Chuck is currently an emeritus professor from the English department at UW-Eau Claire, and I had the privilege of seeing him in situ up in Eau Claire last year when I went and spoke to their faculty group. So this is the second half of that exchange program, and I think we're getting the better deal on that one for sure. Chuck graduated from Lawrence University with a degree in English, and after serving our country as an enlisted man in the Army, wound up at George Washington University, where after, I don't know how long you were there, Chuck, but he earned a PhD in English literature, so I'm assuming it was a while, and he began teaching at UW-Eau Claire in 1976. He retired 31 years later in 2007. But they couldn't keep him down, so he is continuing to serve in the honors program at UW-Eau Claire, where he's currently teaching a course in Russian literature and translation. His signature course over much of his career, though, in the honors program was a course on autobiography. And because our theme this year is on faithful presence, taking a cue from James Davison's Hunter's book, and you may remember if you were here, Eric Carlson helped us kick off that discussion, I thought hearing about autobiography might be really useful for us because it helps us to think about how God might be using our own lives to accomplish His kingdom purposes when we demonstrate faithful presence. And autobiography is a kind of genre that many of us are not used to thinking about. I know I have not written anything on the comparable to Benjamin Franklin's tome or anything else that we might consider today. But I think it's going to be useful to us. And I'd also am intrigued by the way that Chuck has been able in that course to interweave concepts that allow Christianity to be on the table at a public university. And so I'm really looking forward to this. And Chuck, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. And I'll turn the mic over to you. We're going to try to record this today, Lord willing. Especially yours, John. That's right.
I am going to need to use this lectern because I have some notes that I'm going to use. Well, thank you, Jeff, for that introduction. Jeff came to speak to our annual fall prayer lunch a year ago at UW-Eau Claire, and we were delighted to have him. We were able to invite quite a variety of faculty and staff to that lunch, and Jeff presented his interest in science and his faith as a Christian in such an effective way. And he suggested even then that I might be invited back here. So I wasn't entirely surprised when I got the invitation. I'm glad to be here. Over the years, it is true that I've taught this course in autobiography as part of the honors program, and I'm still working in the honors program, and I enjoy that tremendously. After retiring for 1 year, I went back to the director of the honors program and asked, "Do you have some classes I could teach? Could you use me here?" And of course, they were glad to have me come back. For one thing, I'm an old vet. I've been part of the program a long time. Secondly, I'm available. The director doesn't have to arm wrestle with a department chair to get the use of my services. And the third reason that I'm perhaps an appealing candidate is that I'm cheap. I can come back, and I'm glad to do it. Today, as I present these thoughts about autobiography and memoir, my course has evolved over the years. It began as a course in autobiography focusing on some of the great historical texts, Augustine's Confessions, Rousseau's Confessions, Ben Franklin's autobiography, and others. Over the years, it's evolved into more of a course in modern American memoir. So, because I think in the last 2 decades and longer, we've been experiencing a phenomenon in the publishing world that shows no signs of abating, and that has been the widespread popularity of autobiographical writing of all kinds. According to one critic, we're living in an age of literary memoir. Life writing is in vogue, and the contemporary memoir is its current manifestation. This phenomenon has certainly not gone unnoticed. Journalists, book critics, and literary scholars have been paying close attention. At first, they were curious and generally approving. Then, as this vogue continued, some of them became sarcastic and testy, accusing memoir writers of being self-indulgent and narcissistic. More recently, it seems to me, the tendency has been to accept the memoir vogue as a current fashion in literary production, one that has been with us for several decades, and it is no longer quite the phenomenon it was 20 years ago. More than 200 memoirs are published every year, including some false memoirs. A Million Little Pieces, James Fry, and of course now that's the kind of memoir that often gets more attention than some of the others. Some of the titles that you've heard about, let me just show you a couple of the titles that you may have heard about concerning memoir. Mary Carr's The Liar's Club is one. Another memoir that I've enjoyed teaching in class is Rick Bragg's All Over But the Shoutin'. A very moving story. And Tobias Wolff's This Boy's Life. I trace the emergence of this particular type of life writing back to the 1960s, to the later 1960s, and to a book by Frank Conroy called Stop Time. Later, Frank Conroy was the director for many years of the Writer's School at the University of Iowa, the most prestigious writing program in the country. But this is the book that really made Conroy famous. In writing this story, in writing this memoir, Conroy used the resources of literary art to tell a very personal story. He didn't call his book a memoir then. You'll notice on a more recent editions, it says "Stop Time, a Memoir," and you'll see the word memoir attached to so many contemporary books of this kind. It wasn't called a memoir then, because back in 1967, the word memoir didn't have quite the same meaning that it has today. But it had all the qualities, all the ingredients of contemporary memoir. And I think this book really is kind of the prototype of that kind of narrative. These are some of the elements that you'll find in contemporary memoir. Often a sensitive protagonist, highly verbal, somehow wounded in spirit, if not in body. Often a very dysfunctional family, very dysfunctional family. If you begin reading around in some of these memoirs, you'll discover just how twisted and strange some of these family backgrounds really are. A confused and troubled adolescence. A sense of being at odds with the world, being an outsider, being a misfit. But often an intuitive, groping search for meaning, for purpose, for an understanding of life. Not so much to be understood as to understand what life is all about. And a tendency to focus on certain moments of experience with particular intensity. The title itself, Stop Time, I think is a kind of allusion to that. Conroy was a very accomplished jazz pianist. The term Stop Time comes from jazz music, and yet it does seem to apply in this narrative to those moments of particular intensity. Wordsworth called these moments spots of time, and so this book has many of those spots of time, and I think that is a tendency or characteristic of other books of this type. The book called Stop Time, what startled and surprised many of its first readers who wrote about the book was the way in which this very personal story, apparently a true story, had all the qualities of good fiction. But it wasn't fiction. It was a true story. It was a catcher in the rye kind of story, but not a work of fiction like that. What also seemed remarkable to readers and reviewers back in 1967 was that Conroy had as yet done nothing remarkable in life except to publish this book. He was about 30 years old when the book was published, and this book was his most remarkable achievement up to that point. Now, as I said a few moments ago, Conroy did go on to have a very distinguished career as a writer, but even more so as a director of a well-known writing school. But what made this book different from other memoirs of this kind is that historically, memoirs were often narratives, reminiscences written by people who had already achieved some kind of public fame or public distinction. And this book was not that kind of story. Instead of telling stories about behind the scenes incidents and events in a well-publicized public life, it focused on those moments of adolescence often. Often adolescence was the period that was presented with particular vividness and poignancy. And I think Stop Time changed all that. It marked a moment in our recent cultural history when a hitherto unknown young person could publish a personal story that could be appealing, interesting, compelling, simply because of the intensity of those remembered experiences. Now, as I said, this outpouring of personal narrative, life writing of this new kind, has produced hundreds of titles. I brought along one book that has a title that I think is kind of intriguing. It's Dave Eggers, a heartbreaking work of staggering genius. And I think in some respects this title, of course it's a tongue-in-cheek title, there's a lot of irony that goes there, but in some respects this title really, I think, captures a sense of what many of these books are like. You could say in some ways this is a heartbreaking work of staggering genius, and and there are others too. And Eggers has just simply tapped into that interest in stories of this kind. Along with these more secular memoirs, there are some other memoirs that have a more religious or spiritual focus. Traveling Mercies by Anne Lamott is one of those, and I brought several of those titles with me. Traveling Mercies. Mary Carr is continuing to describe some of her personal experiences, and I think this is a very interesting continuation of the Mary Carr story. It's called Lit, and the title is really kind of a play on words. Mary Carr writes about her struggles with alcoholism, coming to realize that she was indeed an alcoholic, but somehow she found her way to faith in Jesus Christ. And so she became lit in another way. Interesting title. Anne Lamott also. Anne Lamott got attention originally for a very interesting book about writing, Bird by Bird. And that was the book that just brought her to the attention of many English teachers across the country, because her insights into the activity of writing were just so insightful, and she's so candid and so down to earth. And many people found her book about writing, Bird by Bird, to be fascinating. What they didn't know is that there was a personal story that was even more compelling. And Anne Lamott tells that story in this book called Traveling Mercies. And this is one of the excerpts that you have in front of you. I'm not going to read these excerpts. I've put them on the table because, as I told the different tables, I can't do a presentation like this without having some handouts, but I want you to take this away with you. I don't think I want to even attempt to read this story, because I happen to be one of those people who has his feelings on his sleeve. I'm just wired that way. And when I read stories that are moving to me, you know, I get choked up. So I have to watch myself in public, because I don't want to start reading some story that's going to make it difficult for me to finish. And honestly, her story is one of those stories. I think as you read her brief account of coming to faith, you'll find yourself very moved by that. And here's a woman who is just so brutally honest about her life and her experience. This is this new style memoir. It's different from some of those older, more conventional autobiographies. This book by Dan Wakefield is also a fascinating narrative. In some respects, this book is a little more like a conventional or traditional autobiography or spiritual autobiography, and that actually brings me to the subject of today's talk. I didn't really intend to delve deeply into contemporary memoir, but I felt I couldn't begin this talk without talking about what seems to be happening right now in our own American literary culture and the enormous interest and popularity of memoir writing in general. You know, I might just say in passing, as I've learned to know some of you here today, I think there are those of you who have stories to tell. And perhaps one of the effects of this meeting, one of the consequences might be that you will be encouraged, prompted to seek to tell your story, because I think these stories are worth sharing. But let's talk about spiritual autobiography, patterns and paradigms. When John asked for a title, I tried to think of something clever and interesting, and because the journey metaphor is a constant one and often turns up in some form or another in titles, I was trying to think about a title that would have to do with roads and road maps, and I couldn't come up with anything clever. So I ended up with a very pedantic title, Spiritual Autobiography, Patterns and Paradigms. And that gives me a certain amount of scope to talk about some of the features, some of the characteristics of spiritual autobiography. My purpose today is to glance very briefly at the history of that strain of writing, commonly known as spiritual autobiography, to describe briefly some of the patterns, some of the basic patterns in spiritual autobiography, to identify what I believe is an essential element in stories of spiritual transformation. And here's where I'm really looking for some feedback from you. I hope we'll have an opportunity to talk about this a bit, because I'd like to know what you think about this idea that I want to share with you, about this essential ingredient. And finally, perhaps we can conclude by just talking about the enduring relevance and popularity of spiritual autobiography. As I was making some notes, I discovered something that kind of surprised me. I discovered that my main points could be represented by a series of words all starting with P. Now, I'm not a preacher, but I thought, this is really interesting. This is the sort of thing that preachers do, isn't it? The topics I want to touch on briefly are these: prototypes, periods, as in literary or cultural historical periods, patterns, and paradigms. Four P's. I feel like a preacher when I say that. All right, let's start with prototypes. The tradition of spiritual autobiography in Western literature is commonly traced back to the Confessions of St. Augustine, which was written in the last years of the 4th century CE, back in 397 and 398 CE. Augustine was born in North Africa in 354, more than 1600 years ago, and he died 76 years later in Hippo in North Africa. In the year of his death, 430 CE, the city of Hippo was under siege and the great Roman Empire was crumbling. Now, while the Confessions is commonly seen as the prototype of spiritual autobiography in Western civilization, it's not the first great story of conversion in the Christian tradition. The first great story of Christian conversion is that of the Apostle Paul, whose story of conversion is narrated three times in the book of Acts. Once by Luke the narrator, and then two more times. Of course, Luke is telling the story, but he is allowing Paul to tell his story. So the story of Paul's conversion is presented to us three times. It's interesting to compare and contrast those stories. Without a doubt, Paul's dramatic story of right-angle conversion has served as a profoundly important point of reference in talking about Christian conversion, but it's not the model that represents the experience of most people who become Christians, because it's so sudden, it's so dramatic. Now, we sometimes talk about Damascus Road experiences, and the moment I say it's just not the experience of most Christians, probably somebody is thinking, but I know a story like that. I know somebody who was antagonistic and angry toward Christianity, and all at once everything changed. Well, those stories do exist. They're remarkable, they're fascinating stories, but they're not typical, are they? I don't think they're typical. Augustine's story, in some ways, has been a more useful model, you might say. What made it so distinctively different? One reason why we say that before Augustine there was no life writing of this kind is this: it's intensely introspective focus. It's that account of the inner struggle. Now, there were life stories that had been told before Augustine's time. Plutarch's Parallel Lives was certainly a very popular book. But Plutarch's lives focused on the lives of noble or effective, successful people. Augustine was a successful person, but his book doesn't talk about his public successes. And it leaves out a lot of other details that would probably appear in a more public story. It says almost nothing about the mistress that he loved deeply, who was the mother of his son. He just barely mentions her. In fact, I'm not even sure he does mention her. I have to stop and think about that. There are many details in his life that are simply not included, but he does focus on that inward struggle. And there's a psychological insight and a penetration. He raises questions about himself. Why did I think that way? Why did I feel that way? One of those episodes that seems so minor, you wonder, why would he put it in the story, is the famous episode of climbing into the courtyard and stealing some apples. He and some other teenage friends climbed into a neighbor's apple orchard and stole some apples. And they thought it was great fun at the time. Years later, Augustine looks back and wondered, now why did I do that? Why did I do that? And he just probes, and he comes up with the conclusion, I think, I really don't know why, except there was just something in my nature that made me want to do that. The apples weren't good. They served no useful purpose. We accomplished nothing. But something about that act of rebellion, that act of theft, thievery, was satisfying. And so he probes experiences like that. Of course, Augustine spent about 9 years in the company of Manichees, and he describes the way in which he examined some of those Manichee ideas. And I think they were really, he was trying to find answers. One of the questions that deeply troubled Augustine was the origin of evil. Where does evil come from? What is evil? And I think for a time he felt he had found some answers in the Manichee teachings. But as time went on, Augustine discovered these ideas, these doctrines really don't answer that fundamental question. And there were other concerns too. So Augustine describes this process that leads him finally to a moment when he becomes a believer and a follower of Jesus Christ. So it becomes a classic, prototypical spiritual autobiography. Interestingly enough, even though Augustine continued to be a major influence on Christian thought for the next 1,000 years and more, his autobiography or his confessions really did not become a model for spiritual autobiography until about the 17th century. And that brings me to my second point. Prototypes, now we're talking about periods. In the 17th century, suddenly there was just an outpouring of spiritual autobiographies, spiritual reflections of all kinds. Now, why should that be so? Well, the 17th century was a tumultuous century in terms of religious conflict, religious warfare, and it may well be that many of the spiritual narratives, spiritual autobiographies had some polemical purpose. By that I mean they were attempting to validate the experience of being a Quaker, perhaps, or being a Puritan. In fact, there were so many Puritan autobiographies written that now scholars study the Puritan autobiography. I've read books on the subject. I've read articles on the subject of the Puritan autobiography. Well, in order to write books and articles like that, you have to have a body of material, of literature to investigate and explore. And there was just an amazing number. Several classic examples, I'll just mention them in passing. John Bunyan's Grace Abounding. The full title is Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. It's a fascinating story about a man who just struggled and struggled for a long time before he finally came to a place of peace and rest. Is it necessary to struggle so much? Well, it's an interesting story. Of course, we know John Bunyan as the author of Pilgrim's Progress, which is another way of dealing with spiritual experience. And that has become, of course, one of the classics One of the literary classics of the 17th century, as well as, I think, a religious and spiritual classic. Another autobiography that I've taught in classes a few times is John Winthrop's autobiography. One of many, of course, but John Winthrop is famous in American history and American literature for that speech he delivered aboard the Arbella. We think it was aboard the Arbella when he said, "We shall be as a city set on a hill." And we've heard that a few times in recent years. Well, John Winthrop was a deeply spiritual man, and his account of his spiritual journey is fascinating. And there seem to be certain traits and characteristics that we find in a number of these spiritual autobiographies. What are the patterns? What is spiritual autobiography? Well, how does the story work? Is it possible to discover patterns in narratives that are so diverse from different centuries? Well, it is possible, I believe, to find certain patterns. In fact, even though one would say, every story is unique. Your story is unique for you. Your story is unique for you. Nevertheless, there seem to be certain basic patterns, or at least one fundamental pattern. In fact, the fundamental pattern in spiritual autobiography is really very simple. And it could be expressed in these words. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. You know, if you want to just boil it down to the essence, that is the story. And in many respects, stories of spiritual autobiography are stories of before and after, with the experience of conversion serving as the pivotal event in a series of events leading to the spiritual transformation. Now, it is also true that in such stories of before and after, there's often a disproportionate emphasis on the before. And I think there might be several reasons why we tend to focus more on the events leading up to the moment of conversion, and much less attention is given to what follows the conversion. For one thing, the story of what comes before the conversion is the story that's often the most interesting. The struggles, the conflicts, the tensions that a person experiences, we're fascinated by those stories of struggle and conflict. We can relate to those, and so we're interested in that part of the story. But there's also this to consider. Every story has to end, and a good story often ends on a high point. You need a climax. That's why when we talk about drama, we talk about rising action leading up to the climax of the story. And then any good dramatist or any good storyteller knows that once you give the punchline, you have to finish the story quickly. You can't let it go on and on, or it becomes anticlimactic. And that may explain why conversion stories, spiritual autobiographies, often spend more time leading up to that moment of conversion, because that is the pivotal event in the story. That's the climax. And once that has occurred, the story needs to end. I think there are some narrative constraints that writers often feel, even if they're not fully thinking about them all the time. And so what is true of spiritual autobiography, as of autobiography in general, the life goes on, but the story ends. But in addition to that very general pattern, I believe that there are several other patterns that we find. In fact, in his famous Gifford Lectures, William James talks briefly about two types of conversion stories. And he uses medical terms to distinguish one type from the other. He talks about the lysis experience and the crisis experience. Another parallel terms would be a story of the volitional kind, where a person is just actively, willfully searching for answers, looking for the key that will unlock the door, that sort of thing. There's that kind of story. And then there's the other kind of story. Now, the story in which the crisis experience is emphasized is a story, it could be compared to what happens perhaps when a person becomes ill. In some cases, you catch a cold and you just have to give yourself a little time and you recover, and then you feel strong again and healthy and off you go. But in other situations, a person becomes ill, the fever rises, the temperature spikes, and then there's a moment of crisis. What's going to happen? This is the moment of crisis. But then at that moment of crisis, suddenly the fever breaks and the person begins to recover. That kind of story is often more interesting, as William James acknowledges. The first kind, a more progressive, developmental kind of conversion story, may be interesting, but often the second kind is more dramatic. But even William James acknowledges that while it's possible to see two different types of two different patterns in spiritual narratives, often there is a kind of conflation of them. And because, in the interest of time, I'm watching the clock and I'm just realizing how quickly the time goes. So I'm going to have to just summarize some of these things very quickly for you, because I would like to get your response to one of my questions as we come to the end of this. But in Augustine's Confessions, for example, Augustine spends a number of chapters, a number of books, he calls them books, in which he describes his journey toward faith or toward belief. Then finally, the time comes that by the time we get to the end of book 7 in the Confessions, for all practical purposes, Augustine believes. He doesn't have any more intellectual questions. He believes that Jesus is the Christ. He believes that Christianity is true, that it answers his questions. So why doesn't he instantly become a Christian? Well, there's still some resistance. And Augustine is baffled by this, but he describes in chapter 8. I think chapter 8, or book 8, is often the favorite chapter, because that's the chapter people often think about when they think about Augustine. He was feeling such distress, such turmoil. He describes going into the garden. And in fact, he even banged his head against the wall. He was feeling so emotionally distraught. Tearing his hair. I mean, this is wonderful. This is emotion and passion. And then he heard the voice of the child. Tolo lege, take and read. And he took that as a message from God. So he picked up a portion of scripture that he had, and his eyes lighted on the very passage that seemed to address this issue. I don't recommend this as a way to do Bible study. And it's interesting that that someone like Augustine would actually do something like that. Augustine has been described as a thinking machine. I mean, he was an intellectual, and yet, in a very simple way, that experience brought him to the point of following Jesus. Now, I think that emotional episode in the garden, that wasn't really what brought him to the point of believing and embracing Christianity intellectually, but there was still the matter of the human will. And he had to surrender that will. And so that book 8 is the story of how Augustine's will is finally surrendered. So that part of the story very much fits the pattern of the crisis conversion, whereas the books leading up to that would be a little more consistent with the lysis, or the developmental, the volitional kind of spiritual autobiography. My point then is just simply that we're probably going to find both patterns represented in many of these autobiographies. At one time, when I first read William James's distinction, I thought, that's really interesting. That really explains a lot. And for a long time, I just kind of believed, that's the way it is. You can put them into two categories. Well, I'm older now, and I've discovered it's not that simple. And as I examine some of these texts, I realize you can't just put them into one compartment or the other, because you find elements of both. Well, we've talked a little about patterns, and now I come to this last topic, paradigms. And here's where I'm looking for some feedback from you, some insight from you, if you can offer some. What about paradigms? For more than 40 years, ever since Thomas Kuhn published his famous book back in 1962, the term paradigm shift has been widely used to explain a variety of developments in all the disciplines. And today, in this talk, I'm using the term paradigm shift as a way of speaking about a moment in every story of conversion when a particular conception of reality, a way of seeing the world, is for some reason called into question, with the result that another way of seeing reality, another worldview, becomes a possibility. And it's my belief that a paradigm shift of some kind is an essential element in every conversion story. Now, I've never seen anybody develop this idea, and so I'm feeling a little tentative with this idea. But I'd like you to think about it with me for a few moments and just see what you think about this. Maybe the term paradigm shift is a little too big, a little too clumsy for this. But I think you'll see what I mean in a moment when I give you one or two illustrations. What I'm talking about now is just something that will cause a person to question his or her assumptions about the way things are, about the way the world is. I think some of these are worldview issues. Something is said, some comment is made, something happens that causes the person to begin to wonder, is that really true? Or could there be another way of seeing things? Is there another window on reality that I've never looked out before? I believe that for conversion to take place, that has to happen. I think that's an essential ingredient. And I think perhaps I'll just briefly skip over Augustine. I think for Augustine there is that kind of development. One of the difficulties that Augustine had as a young intellectual in his 20s is that he could not understand how something could exist that did not have some kind of tangible material substance. How could anything exist that did not have some kind of tangible material substance? And he didn't know how to resolve that. But then a friend of his directed his attention to some of the writings of the Platonists. Now, Augustine was wonderfully proficient in Latin, but he was not a Greek scholar. So the writings of the Platonists had to be translated into Latin, and they became available to him. And so he began to read the writings of the Platonists, and that is what shifted his perspective. He began to see that it is possible for an entity, a being, to exist who is non-corporeal. That he began to understand something about the nature of spiritual existence or spiritual reality he had never considered before. Now that didn't bring him to faith. He didn't become a Christian at that point. But it was that shift, call it a paradigm shift, that made it possible for him then to hear the message that St. Ambrose is preaching. St. Ambrose was the preacher that Augustine went to hear. He went to hear St. Ambrose because he heard that he was a good speaker. And Augustine loved listening to eloquent speakers. But as he listened to Ambrose begin to explain the scriptures, he began to realize the scriptures aren't as simplistic as I had thought. There's wisdom there. And he began to understand how to read and how to interpret the scriptures. And because of he was already open to the possibility, it was, I think, the preaching of St. Ambrose that was highly instrumental. It wasn't the only factor. One of the things we discover, I think, as we read spiritual autobiographies, that there are often a number of factors that play into this moment. And certainly C.S. Lewis describes some of those in his narrative. But there is one moment that continues to fascinate me. And I wonder what you're going to say about this. Now, in telling his story, C.S. Lewis went through a period of adolescent atheism. But then, as a young adult, a young intellectual, he was persuaded by the writings of the philosopher F.H. Bradley to embrace a form of philosophical idealism, which is still a few steps from Christianity, Christian faith, but he was moving in that direction. But it's unlikely that C.S. Lewis would have become a Christian if there had not been several other events that occurred in his life, several other incidents. And one of those significant moments occurred when a hard-boiled atheist, that's how Lewis describes this person, when a hard-boiled atheist made the following comment. And here's how he tells the story. The real clue concerning other religions, which he just had assumed were just, they're all myths, all ancient stories, tales, legends, they're all just mythology. The real clue had been put into my hand by that hard-boiled atheist when he said, "Rum thing that about a dying God really seems to have happened once." Now, a chance comment like that, why would that have the sort of impact that it did? Wrong thing that, all that about a dying God, seems to have really happened once. That comment was an event that I think started moving, that helped C.S. Lewis begin to move toward Christianity, because that comment, I think, represents a kind of paradigm shift. Or is that term a little too grandiose for what we're talking about here? But I think what it suggested to him is that perhaps what he had thought about those ancient stories wasn't true. That perhaps the story about a God who died and was resurrected, maybe that is historical after all. Rum thing, all that about a dying God. Seems to have really happened once. And it became a possibility. Now, it didn't bring C.S. Lewis immediately to faith. The rest of the story, in fact, there are three episodes that are on the handout I've given you. I think you'll find them very interesting. There were still some steps. The first step was just acknowledging that there is a God. And he writes about that. And you know what's interesting about Lewis's account is that, unlike Augustine, who describes the emotional turmoil that he experienced at the moment when he finally surrendered his will, Lewis talks about how unemotional it was. He was riding on a bus up Headington Hill in Oxford, and it was as though he was being confronted with a choice. What is your choice? He felt no particular constraint, certainly no emotional pressure to respond, but a kind of inevitability. And that was one moment. The second moment, which I love, is when he knelt by his bed in Oxford and acknowledged that God is God. Now, what's interesting about that is he's still not a Christian. He's just simply acknowledging that God is God. He felt he had no choice. That's the second episode. The third episode is an interesting one. Apparently he was riding with his brother in one of those motorcycles with a side cart. They were on their way to the zoo. And as he tells us in the third excerpt, when they started the journey, he didn't believe that Jesus was the Son of God. He hadn't made that decision. When they got to the zoo, he did. Now, how did that happen? I think what's so fascinating about spiritual autobiographies, especially when they are written by writers such as C.S. Lewis and Augustine and so many others, who are people of rare integrity and honesty, they're trying as best they can to describe what happens in the heart and mind and spirit of a person who is changing his mind or changing her mind. That's why the questions on the table in front of you are the questions that they were. I don't know that we're going to have time to answer these questions, but when John asked if I could suggest some questions, these are the questions that came to my mind, and I would love to hear what your responses might be, if we have time for that. When have you ever changed your mind about a topic or an issue? What caused you to change your mind? How hard was it for you to change your thinking? Was it a sudden decision, or was it the result of a long, slow process? People are always changing their minds. I've changed my mind. You've changed your mind about a lot of things. We all have. How does that happen? That's the process that fascinates me. I'm not sure we're going to find a precise answer in spiritual autobiography, but these are stories. These are narratives that describe how people change their thinking. And of course, what we're not talking about today is the fact that for Augustine and for C.S. Lewis and for many other writers, there is also God's mysterious grace that enters in. But how do you talk about God's grace? What these writers talk about are the events and circumstances in their lives and those moments in their lives when something happened that caused them to raise questions, doubt what they had believed to that point, and prepare them to respond to another way of seeing the world, another view of reality, preparing them to just be open to the possibility that the message of Jesus Christ is true. And they respond. Spiritual autobiography. And now, of course, we're living in an age of memoir. I think there are a lot of good books out there that you're going to enjoy reading, and I hope that some of you here might be prompted to tell your stories, because people are interested. They want to hear those stories, and I'd love to hear your stories too. Thank you very much. Jeff.
So Chuck, one thing I'm struck by in a number of these stories are seemingly small events that it seems as if there's a predisposition to undergo a paradigm shift, but there needs to be a trigger,
right,
to help the person make the shift.
Mm-hmm.
And in retrospect, Lewis is an example. He seems to be looking backward, and it's obvious, but only in retrospect.
Right.
And I think something I'm struck by, perhaps, is that maybe we don't recognize the, I won't say random, I'll say providential impact of small things.
Exactly.
That are used by God in someone's life. We may have no way of knowing. We may never know.
That's right.
And yet God autobiographically seems to use these events in ways that are maybe not always easily predictable.
Jeff, I think you're absolutely right. And I can think of several friends who've told stories about just a chance remark, a chance comment that triggered a thought. And Francis Collins, in his well-received book, I forget the title right now.
Do you know? Language of God.
The Language of God. In that book, that's really, to me, that's kind of a hybrid book. There is an element of spiritual autobiography in Francis Collins' book, in which he tells his own story of coming to faith. And then, of course, he spends a fair amount of time just talking about his work as a scientific researcher. But in his experience, as I recall, he was just meeting a simple country woman who made a comment, some remark, that in response to a question of his. And it was just a very minor, seemingly insignificant event, and yet it had a profound impact on this highly respected contemporary scientist. So that, I think, we can find other instances too, when some seemingly chance event is the trigger. I like the way you put that. You know, I'm not sure if we can call this a paradigm shift, but something triggers that change of perspective. And as I said a few moments ago, I think in order for a person to become a believer, some kind of paradigm shift must occur. And the reason for that is I believe that Christianity does give us a worldview. And one reason why some people can't hear the message of Christianity is because they have a different worldview. Their worldview does not allow them to be open to what might seem to be evidence. So something has to happen to challenge that worldview so that they can begin to consider the possibility of another. John?
One of the things I've discovered listening to students and faculty tell their story is somewhat like what we find with Lewis, and that is you get people like Terry Eagleton, who's a theorist, Marxist theorist, who's not a believer, but he talks about Christianity having a propositional content and a performative aspect of the way that we live. And then further, we could describe a worldview change. And listening to students tell their story about how they become Christians, or watching grad students become Christians, the worldview change is almost always the last thing that happens.
Right.
That there's propositional content that they're ready to say yes to.
Right.
And they begin to live. Okay, this is what it means to live like a Christian. And then watch the community around them and say, okay, I'm going to live this way. But then there's a worldview change. That's almost always the third thing that happens. And
right.
That's when things become fully lit.
Right. I like the way you're describing this, John, because I think there is a process here. But something has to happen with that initial worldview, because if a person firmly embraced a particular worldview, you can give all kinds of evidence of one kind or another, and it's not going to affect that person. Something has to jar that particular worldview, I think. Something has to, I guess this is where the idea of the paradigm shift seems important to me, because some sort of anomaly has to be presented that doesn't fit well with that worldview, that somehow questions or challenges that existing worldview. And so once the possibility is presented of another way of thinking, it may still be a process. It may still be a time before a person moves in that direction, but now there's a possibility. And I think for Lewis, when he heard the hard-boiled atheist say, "Rum thing that about a dying God, seems to have happened once," it just, suddenly that was a possibility. Could it be that there was once a God who died? Could that be? And I think it just began, it just assisted, it was that trigger that Jeff spoke of.
I think there's another aspect to this too. I was just mentioning to folks at the table that I've observed that, you know, back in the day when I was a student, we would argue and debate about spiritual things without regard for, well, I probably think too fondly of those days. without regard for whether my opinion was crushed or I had a lot to lose or whatever. And yet it seems like the older we get, it's almost like, and I'm not just talking about myself, but kind of an observation of people my age, we have so much invested in what we believe so far that it involves giving up so much to change, you know, to agree, to say, you know what, maybe the, if I can use the example, maybe the Republican perspective is correct. I say that with, you know, its intended effect, that it just involves such a remarkable transformation. It's that, you know, people just can't get past. I understand the point about, you know, there's something that causes you to ruminate about something someone said, or maybe it's a life episode, you know. For example, Steve Jobs recognizing that he was going to die. We often hear about that, you know, that there's this long period in our lives when we don't really change too much, but then when we get toward an episode of mortality, that then we're more open, or then, you know, it's almost like we're not so much concerned with what we've invested as we are in what we might miss, you know, at the end of our lives. So. Anyway, I was just kind of...
That's a very interesting comment. Thank you for that. And yes,
I don't know how to break through that in conversations with people. But
I think it helps us to understand, though, why it is that those moments when we experience something very disruptive, there is a reason why men in jail come to faith in Christ. I go as a volunteer to the jail once a week. And I'm trying to do more than just encourage these fellows. What I really... I'm doing when I go to the jails, I'm trying to present something that will help them to discover how they can transform their lives. And so I try to listen to what they have to say and try to find some way of offering a window of hope, a window of opportunity, something that will really transform their lives. And experiences like that, of course, would make a person think. Dealing with a terminal illness would certainly cause something like that to happen, I would think. Yes?
I think maybe there are some of us, like me and Ruth, who find this super encouraging, just because for those of us who don't necessarily have the gift of evangelism, but want to live lives of bearing fruit, and I like the notion that living with transparency and integrity and being willing to make small comments matters.
It does matter. Good. I'm glad you got that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that.
Maybe that's a great place for us to end. Let's thank Chuck for a really wonderful session.
Thanks for coming. Glad. Now, be sure to read the handouts. I think you'll really enjoy the excerpt from Anne Lamott's book. And Chuck Colson's story is in some ways, I think, a little more conventional spiritual autobiography of the kind we're talking about, where the narrative explores his life and tries to trace that development that brought him to faith. And of course, C.S. Lewis's Surprised by Joy. If you haven't read Surprised by Joy, you might want to pick that up and just save it for a holiday period. It's not a hard book to read.
Watch your inbox for further announcements regarding both our prayer meetings and for the luncheons up the road.